Excuse me for speaking English. My French is definitely not that fluent, so I'm really happy I can speak in English. Thank you for the invitation and to this very interesting colloque, The Politics of Architecture, Architecture of Politics. And I'm also very happy and honored that I can bring here the product of my research here, that is the book on Jaap Bakema and his idea for the open society. Jaap Bakema was a Dutch architect. He was born in 1914 and he prematurely died in 1981, 66 years old. He had lived a life of three people, maybe four people, traveling around the world, teaching everywhere on all sorts of universities, also in the United States. He was the principal of one of the biggest offices in the Netherlands, the Rotterdam Architecture Office van den Broek en Bakema, and therefore responsible for quite a large portfolio of projects in the Netherlands, but also in Germany and other places. And he was a full professor in Delft, the university where I teach as well. Usually Bakema is always talked about in terms of collaborations and collectives. It's very hard to focus on Jaap Bakema as an author and a person because he always appears in groups or duos, etc. And even in anthologies of his texts that he produced himself, he includes the texts of adversaries for polemical sake, I think, but also because he respected these adversaries, and I think it was also part of his idea that debate and criticism was always needed to arrive at better solutions, better approaches in a period of rebuilding a country and constructing a completely modernized nation, that is the country of the Netherlands. And one of the themes for that particular project, in 1948, he became, together with Jo van den Broek, the head of this office van den Broek en Bakema. And from there on, he started to develop this project, you could say. One of the main themes for this project was this rather versatile term or slippery term of the open society. And what I'd like to do for today is to focus on what this term might mean for architecture and especially for Bakema, and how he instrumentalized it and how he used it to communicate about architecture. Because this is also important to understand that Bakema was a fantastic communicator. His special quality was lied in being capable of bridging the gap between avant-garde discourse and mainstream culture. And I will point out a few of those moments. This is a project I start with. It's the design he made together with a young architect called Karel Weber. It's the design for the Dutch Pavilion for the Expo in 1970 in Osaka, the World's Fair that would bring Japan back fully fledged as the new had a new modern Japan, leaving all the misery from the Second World War behind. Kenzo Tange was the supervisor. A lot of metabolist architects were also involved. Metabolism was the post-war movement in Japan for architects, and Bakema stood in close connection with these people. What you're looking at is his sketch for what he called a communication machine. Architecture was a communication machine. Architecture, its function, its prime function was to make people aware of the larger environment they were part of. Architecture wasn't really directive in that sense, but it was instrumental in it. And the communication, the things that he wanted to communicate with this pavilion is not only this specific message or he had for as an architect, but also the Dutch national identity. an identity which was highly modern, very much advanced, a progressive nation, even maybe you could say a post-national sort of identity, because Bakema would hardly discuss Dutch culture and was definitely not a nationalist. And so there are very funny things there, like anecdotal things, like every day there would be that was the idea, to release pigeons and to play what we call in Dutch a carillon, music with bells. Once a day it says the pigeon should be released. And the water feature was part, of course, of the Dutch identity. So there are anecdotal elements there to bring, again, a much more important story there. Here is a model that was not built. This was eventually built. A big machine. The audience were taken into this machine, and there would be a multi-screen story that you could see from escalators going up with a special composition, musical composition. Various artists were involved, as well as the designer Wim Kauwel. The project itself is not so important here for this colloquium. What is important is how Bakema wanted to use this project. So it goes back to other fascinations. This is his office, and you see this particular model, his design for the Euromast Tower, which was built by a colleague of his in Rotterdam, Maaskant. So this is 58. A design for that project, also part of a big manifestation to reach out to the larger audience, a democratic crowd. Here's a photo from the archive. And it is, again, about communicating and educating the new Dutch audience in the post-war period about heads is in Rotterdam. After the war, it would became one of the main ports for Western Europe. This is about the level of the city, the level of the port, the level of the region, the level of the whole hinterland. So it's almost like a Patrick Geddes clock tower, where views and experiences are related to a almost ideological political program. Now, where Bakema completely appears as an author, one of the problems, as I said, is trying to focus on Bakema as an author, because he worked in this big office, and then when you talk to contemporaries, or for instance his former assistants, they would always say that there are other designers. And in the context of Team 10, he was one of the protagonists of the Team 10 group. They would always say, yeah, but Van Eyck was much more intellectual and much more of an artist. Others would say, there's always, in the Dutch context, I'm talking about the Dutch context, now there's people who would like to diminish his contribution. And that is indeed because he never really delivered this manifesto-like product. Now, where he emerges as this, let's say, unified author is in these notes, as this example, and in his sketches, often done after the project, to recapture a project, to present a project, to communicate the results, his intentions, etc. And this is quite clear in one sheet what his program was for this particular national pavilion in Osaka, 1970, we're talking about. And he starts with the Netherlands. A country is planning its change. It's an open society, an open economy. So here already we see maybe a shift from the early Bakema to the late Bakema, where the open society becomes more of a neoliberal program than the democratic program that he uses in the beginning, in the 50s. He goes on. About talking about teamwork. It's about planning, it's about water management, it's about spatial planning, and it's about the knowledge economy, it's about education, higher education, science and art, And then it's about results. And we're talking about world fair, so and the open economy. The common market was just coming into being in Europe, Western Europe. So we have Schiphol. We have a couple of names of Dutch multinationals. We have communications again in terms of a radio telescope. The harbor is mentioned, KLM, Philips, etc. So open economy, global markets is part of this idea already. And then he links it to an aesthetic program, very basic. It's about airs, the air, the skies. It's about the Dutch lights. It's about specific colors in the terms of meadows, grass. It's about corn, the grain fields. It's about flowers. And then he relates that to Dutch painting, Rembrandt, Mondrian, Van Gogh. And then there's one very funny item here, which is called Provo. I don't know whether you know Provo, the counterculture movement in Holland. They're contemporaries of the Situationists. And Provo, this is the mid-60s, gained notoriety by throwing a smoke bomb during the wedding of the crown princess, the later Queen Beatrix. They were an Amsterdam-based group. And what is so interesting about Bakema, I already mentioned that he included adversaries in his own teachings, in his own textbooks. He would always keep open the communication channels and always include also the counter movements. He had always an eye also for youth movements. And in the CYOM conference, he always talks about the young rebels, the Nozems, or the Teddy Boys. Which, I mean, in the terms of developing a national identity, national message to Japan and the world is quite interesting. Provo was very radical. They wanted to disarm the police office, forces, to create, make it into a social sort of support system. They were advocating a white squatter scheme to fight speculation on the housing market. They wanted to arrive at a white bicycle scheme to to fight car pollution in cities, etc. We're talking about 65, 66 here. Very interesting. And there were all sorts of connections between the Delft faculty and the students and what was happening in Amsterdam. This is 69 in the Delft faculty, a brand new building. The Delft campus was actively expanded as in the whole of Europe and America, everywhere. It's part of this knowledge economy. And here's Bakema. Well, what's happening here might be clear enough, I don't know, but it's of course a year after May 68 in Paris. It's also inspired by the Critical University in Berlin. Student and staff radically gain control of the faculty and its governance. It's a one man, one vote system. And Bakema doesn't like it. He's Aldo van Eyck, he does vote, and many students. Well, both were very engaged in this in these discussions, and they were in favor of the changes because the system was very hierarchical and conservative. And particularly Bakema was brought in together with Van den Broek in a gradual opening up of the system. Now, for Bakema, this is interesting because, and I'm not going to expand on this, he was a prisoner of war. He tried to escape to England in 43 and then got caught at the Spanish border and was kept a prisoner in Compiègne. He could escape after half a year and then went into hiding in the north of the Netherlands. So he would say this one man, one vote system that he had seen it before, right? But at the same time, he would negotiate an agreement with the the board of governors of the university, that the faculty of architecture in Delft was allowed to have a kind of experimental status, and that this radical democratic system was allowed to exist for quite a while, for a couple of years. Okay, so where does it come from? Huh? So 1970, radical democratization, and somehow this idea of the open society as Bakema saw it seems to falter. Okay, now I go to a little movie I brought from the archive. This is the movie. It has no sounds. That's the wrong button. This should do it. Yeah, there it goes. This is 1959 in Otterlo. We're at the last CIEM conference, and we won't see Bakema. Once again, it's hard to focus on him because he's holding the camera. So in the archive, we have quite a few of these 60mm films. And in between a visit to the States and a visit to Africa, there's this 1 minute shot of the future Team 10 making fun. And this is Aldo van Eyck and Van Ginkel, the Smithsons, Blanche Lemko. And they are, well, let's say, carrying Siam to its grave. Or at least there's some sort of ceremony bringing modern architecture as we knew it, is symbolically brought to an end. And it's nice also to see it in color, etc. Allison again, there's Peter Smithson, and it's also the Howells. Yes, it was like this in the film. So every now and then we do it in reverse, and sometimes for a photo we re-reverse it, yeah, right? Because it doesn't make sense. So, so this is 59. We're in Otterlo. Last CIEM conference, Otterlo, Kröller-Müller Museum. And thinking about all the networks that you were talking about, what is very important also in relation to the war, the Second World War, is that many of the clients of Bakema, but also the people who were running, so to speak, the Kröller-Müller Museum, there is a kind of underground network of people who were part of the resistance or supportive or somehow related, either fled to England, and every important moment or you can see these connections, and it's very hard to retrieve them because it was the war, so it was something that you weren't open, you had to hide, so there's hardly any documents there, but it's true to say, especially in this case in Otterlo, that there is this network of kind of progressive anti-fascist consensus. They could be communists, they could be Jewish people, they could be socialists or Orthodox Christians too, that work together to get rid of the fascist occupier and recreate a new democratic liberated country. So what happens, for instance, here in the circles around the Kröller-Müller Museum, at some point Bakema gets a special prize, the Prix de la Critique, from an organization which still exists, the artist organization that was established after the Second World War to fight fascism. He got this prize in 61, and in 62, because of the prize, he comes up with this exhibition, Bouwen voor een open samenleving, Building for an Open Society. And he presents the work of the Van der Broek and Bakema office under that particular slogan, appropriating also this term, open samenleving, open society. And when you look who's in the jury, etc., you see the same names, etc. And the Kröller-Müller Museum people They also wanted deliberately to bring people like Siam and Team 10 to their museum to discuss the future of open democracies and how architects and artists could contribute. Now, this is from the daughters, Britta Bakema. Here's Britta. She was a very young girl here, in her teens still. She still holds her interesting documents. And this is like a nice sheet of photos. Who was there? Louis Kahn gave a keynote lecture. Bakema is standing here overlooking the table, if everyone has a beer, I suppose. I don't know. But there's Candilis, there's Aldo van Eyck and Alison Smithson. Here's the sign again. Jerzy Soltan. Here are the deliberations, the presentations, all in the museum, designed by Henry van der Velde, of course, with a fantastic collection of modern art. And these are, of course, the famous publication, at least famous when you are read into the discourse of Team 10 and Dutch Forum, the Dutch branch of Team 10. So Aldo van Eyck and Jaap Bakema at the same time were part of the editorial board of this particular journal called Forum, and they handed this out at the Otterlo conference. The story of an honor ID, they call it. But to show this idea of the proposition of Bakema as bridging avant-garde culture and mainstream, these images are from a TV series he made in 62-63, so again the same period. There was only one national channel in the Netherlands then, and on Sunday evenings he would talk to the nation, talking about modernization, planning, architecture, housing, etc. It was called From Chair to City, because the alliteration in Dutch is very nice, Van Stoel tot Stad. There's an English translation never published which speaks of from doorstep to city, which is much more of a Team 10 term. And there you see again him sketching, right? The sketching is very crucial in him being an author and a persona. There was a special booklet made out of it, a story about people and space. And this is on the cover. There's this crucial diagram: people and space, people and buildings, space between people, space between buildings. The idea of architecture and planning as relational and interrelational is one of the key concepts that he elaborates and brings to Siam. So in 1951, he speaks to the Siam conference in Hoddesdon, and he talks about the relationship between man and things. Yeah, so some people like to now connect it to, for instance, actor network theories of Latour, but this idea that architecture and material things, material objects, architecture and people, there's a social dimension there that is crucial to understand Bakema's contribution. And it's also, there's not a one center, it's an open center. It's very important. It's not Leonardo da Vinci's universal man. The other diagram which I want to show here is how Bakema was thinking in terms of long lines of developments. So modernization, emancipation, democratization. We are not talking about one moment, one decade, not even one century. When he refers to Ortega y Gasset and the revolt of the masses, he talks also about how the anonymous masses come from far away and have this long path, this long marching almost to a new liberated society, democratic, egalitarian society. This is also made around 1960, and he speaks of the moment of 1940, where there is an idea of functionalism and public infrastructure, and then how it becomes much more complicated in the going to the year 2000. He speaks in terms of it as total urbanization, there's this idea of massive growth, a new global condition. He really thinks of a future where there's no national borders anymore. Still, the government is very important to make this open society, this democratic society possible. Because when you look at these domains, the realms of the public and the private, they are interrelated perhaps, but the whole of the land and everything infrastructural is public and owned by the state, which is in those years maybe a natural thing, a matter of course, but of course looking from today's perspective, this is quite striking, I think, where everything is being privatized. Now, the key emblematic projects that symbolize this open society would be the Lijnbaan project, the Lijnbaan shopping center in Rotterdam. Again, a story related to utter destruction and renewal. Rotterdam being bombed by the Germans and then reconstructed straight after the war, plans already being made during the war in all sorts of collective arrangements. And the Lijnbaan scheme lands in the office 1948 when Bakema becomes one of the partners and when Van der Broek is the first modern architecture professor in Delft, and that's also why Bakema is being hired, because Van der Broek is going to teach in Delft, so someone has to run the office and Bakema is that person. And here you see the Lijnbaan, the shops already, but it's a much bigger development because it's also about housing slabs, there are office spaces. Here is the Breuer designed department store of the Bijenkorf. And you see how there is a sort of huge project developed here. This is the first phase only, finished in 1953. And it becomes this icon also propagated by Lewis Mumford, the American historian. It becomes really propagated as the ultimate symbol for this open democratic society. You look worried. Okay. This is a drawing by one of the project architects, Van Gool, and you can see the kind of very elegant sort of new urban spaces, pedestrianized, but also small scale, intimate, and you can also say very much Americanism is there, I think. And this is, I brought two photos which are very rhetorical. They talk about Bakema's idea of, so when you have this scheme of the interrelations between small people and big people, small buildings, big buildings, the transitional elements. These photos are always used to communicate it. So here you are as an individual protected by a canopy, having an overview of the immediate environment, which is a safe space, a space to meet other people, not feeling threatened. And in steps, there's your view, crosses from one volume to another volume to outer space. So this is really back. It's a notion that comes from the Stijl movement, a kind of spatial concept that is about expansion and relational. And Bakema sees himself in that tradition. And here again too, you are here covered and protected. This is the social space to meet one another. In several steps again, you are out to the larger scale. Yeah, this is the aesthetics of number, a typical Aldo van Eyck phrase, of course. Here again, too, it's about counting, it's about how from abstract compositions you can develop. Bakema would say how you would feel, how you can navigate space, how you can orient yourself in this space. This is Berlin, and I put some Cold War things here too. This is the Hansa Viertel project. 57 is the key moment, but the contribution by the Van der Broek and Bakema office, and Bakema together with the project architect Stockla. The project is finished a little bit later. It's still under construction here. And you can see this incredible complex typology. the specific spatial articulation of the main hall, and you enter it here, and how the typology is communicated. But Berlin is not, this. The Hansa Viertel project is not the only project that he is part of, the showcase of a modern approach to planning in cities as part of the antagonisms between the East and the West. He's also entering the competition for the Hauptstadt Berlin competition. Berlin was not divided by a wall then, but this is 58, and the wall was built in 61. And it's for Bakema an important exercise, and this drawing is again about how do you develop an identity for a destroyed city, focusing on its core, the inner city, and these funny shapes, these are crucial here. So traffic is important, of course. Traffic is a new thing then, but these are part of the megastructure debate of those years. So when you think of total urbanization, these massive amount of houses needed and program needed, the megastructure pops up in many architects' ideas. The word itself is from 64, Fumiko Maki, the Japanese architect, also a colleague of Bakema in those Team 10 circles, and with whom he would have many exchanges. Also, when Bakema was teaching in the States, he would meet Maki. It's not quite clear who thinks of what, but anyway, it's again a collective enterprise, you could say. And here you see more of these funny shapes, and they are not functionalist buildings because they are containers for all sorts of programs: housing, universities, shops, offices. 65, earthquake-destroyed city Skopje also needs a new city core. Tito uses the opportunity to bring in the UN, the United Nations. United Nations oversees an international competition. A series of officers from Yugoslavia and from abroad are brought in. Kenzo Tange wins the competition, and this is the contribution by Bakema. And again, this megastructure approach, which to Bakema, in his own wordings, is a response or an embodiment, or it tries to be what he thinks of as the potential of the open society. And he sees the open society as a social structure, as something that can grow and change with the people. Here you see again, this drawing is crucial, where you start to understand a little bit and look at the section and how and the kind of scale you see here, and how it's all integrated into one giant superstructure or megastructure. This is the main street in Skopje, and this is interesting to see how an approach of public space and canopies is used to link buildings that survived the earthquake. And it was part of the competition that these older buildings should be integrated. So it is a piece of the Lijnbaan as a medicine for Skopje. Now, what was such a structure for the open society? This is a model from an exhibition for a city in the south of Holland, Eindhoven. It was a huge exhibition, a very expensive exhibition to inform the city and its citizens what would be possible for its new center. And it was comes very close to what John Habrake called supports and infill. In 61, John Habrake comes up with his radical idea of a support and infill system. In Dutch it's called the Dragers en de Mensen, the end of mass housing in architecture and planning. And it's basically about creating these superstructures or infrastructure, architecture's infrastructure, where you go up with elevators and staircases and piping and plumbing, etc., is all ready being built. And then the infill is then decided later, or at will or what is necessary or wished for, etc. And the most megalomaniac proposal is definitely the Pampus Plan in 64 for Amsterdam. It was meant as a provocation for the city of Amsterdam. It was not a commission, it was not a competition, but the office thought it's necessary to actively intervene in debates of city extensions in Holland, how to deal with mass housing, etc. And they wanted to spare the open land, so they built into the water a gigantic, maybe a mega structure around a new motorway and public transport line to the new polders. And here you see how the functional city is swapped for a kind of, it's almost a culture of congestion that Kohlhaas would start to talk about, but then in a welfare state kind of version. It's also called a five-minute city because living here with a view over the Dutch polder landscape or the water landscape, with a very short walk, you would be at the core, at the spine of this new city, enjoying metropolitan functions. So this was to be the new Dutch, ideally, let's say, a city of 350,000 inhabitants, the new Dutch welfare state, open society. How to wrap it up, I want to explain as a last thing is the open society then was not how the open society is often used today. So in discussions about migration, etc., and Islamophobia, etc., the open society is often used as a term to stand up for progressive ideals, etc. But open society for Bakema, although there's also religion involved actually, was very much about changing the Dutch society, which at that point was rural, agricultural, and religious. And the welfare state system was pretty rigid. So his notion of open society is also his way of venting his criticism towards this system. All sorts of schemes we know from that period, from the cradle to the grave, after the war, the state will take care of you, everybody gets his or her house or their house, and it's neatly organized in cities parceled out into neighborhoods and districts, and then full-blown cities. The idea of the neighborhood is very important in Holland, going back to garden city ideologies. And for Bakema, what then becomes important is to, this transformation of Dutch society. And he finds a collaborator in Lotte Stambeze, who is the head of the Rotterdam Urban Design Department. And they want to start building a city for diversity that takes different walks of life as a starting point rather than a sort of prepackaged anonymous citizen. Now, Dutch society then was what we call in Holland a pillarized society. It was a society of identity politics, maybe silos of identity politics. So you had a Protestant pillar, the Protestants had even several pillars, a Catholic pillar, a humanist pillar, a socialist pillar, etc. What did it mean? It's not only in Holland, it's also in Belgium, for instance. It means that your children go to a Catholic school, that you yourself are a member of a Catholic union, that you vote on a Catholic party, that you get a Catholic pension, etc. And that's for each pillar. And the pillars are never ever to meet, so a Catholic girl would never marry a Protestant boy, of course. Now, one of the ideas to bring in and start mixing the pillars or overcome the pillars is again this idea of the core. And what happens in these schemes, they're not for Pendrecht, they're for many places, also the Nagelen village is very important here. Each denomination gets its own church and school, etc., around this empty core. So even though people will still go to their own school, etc., still they come together and meet. Yeah, like the Leinbahn, this is a space of encountering. And the hope is then that this would bring out a new sort of society. This goes straight to the lowest scale level of the housing block or housing unit. So instead of big slabs here, it's proposed to have smaller units. And this is not so much going back to the pillars, but it is going back to household income, the types of household, whether you're single or elderly, whether you're a young family, etc. So at the lowest scale level, an idea of mixing and diversity is being organized. And then using that small scale elements, then the question comes up, how do you build a larger fabric out of this? And then the neighborhood idea pops in, and all sorts of aesthetic ideas of serialist compositions are being tested. They're being brought to the SIAM conferences. Ideas of a big scale, small scale. This is Bakema again. The bigger scale confronts the landscape, the open landscape. And here he is in Otterlo again with all these drawings behind him. So here's the Pendrecht model I just showed you, for instance. And this is more on a regional scale, because it goes really up to the whole, here's the mega structure again. This is 53. So it's pretty early, but he doesn't call it mega structure. But again, you see infrastructure, housing, planning, landscape being integrated. And this is the sort of typical landscape idea that Bakema envisions, where there's a kind of Dutch sensibility, I think, sensitivity in terms of Ruisdael landscapes meeting the Stijl aesthetics. Well, I'm going to skip this. It's built. Lots of it is already demolished. This is an early example in Nagelen. You see it's clearly a Protestant church. Very austere, 58 again. And this is a town hall for Terneuzen, a small town. And here again, this idea of architecture as infrastructure supporting the community is key. It's a town close to the sea. This is the sea dike. And there was a major flood in 53, killing around 1,500 people. And you see the sort of very heavy architecture being used to communicate a new idea what a government is and what a government does. And here's democracy in action. This is the city council members. This is Queen Juliana then. kind of anomaly in terms of democracy, but still. Bakema, and here's the model. And Alison Smithson called this a historic period then, because and she said that in 74, because this was the moment that the people still trust, well, that's what she says, right? There was still trust between the representatives who would then commission the architect, etc. She speaks of trust here. And that trust to her had gone with radical democratization. Radical democratization to her was built on distrust of authority, which is probably true, but then what do you do? Anyway, interesting to further deliberate on. What happens in the work of the office then? Very briefly, to wrap it up in 2 minutes, really. There's this intense interest and focus on process and all sorts of parameters that are important in design processes, planning, etc. So you see here, this is a plan for a Mümmelmannsberg in Hamburg. And something happens to the language of planning here and the language of architecture, very different from the 50s, 60s welfare state planning. A city like but that's of course totally, it's like a motherboard of a computer. It's something else, a machine. And also Siemens Research Center, incredible commission for the office, $500 million Deutschmark, it's all being analyzed in all sorts of parameters, etc. And then this incredible megastructure is being built. And the last bit is I want to show Tanthof in Delft, another superstructure on this sort of Dutch landscape. And usually in Dutch planning, you put a plate of sand on top of the old landscape, and then you start building a new tabula rasa. But there was protest from all sorts of corners. And a new working group started, a collective working group. The Van den Broek and Bakema office participated and supported it and developed a new, completely new scheme in terms of ecology and using the existing landscape, water structure, soil structure, historical structure as the carrier for the new city extension. So something completely else happens there. And you can see again the language, the articulation of the integration between planning and architecture changes completely. And you can ask kills, many people have asked this question, does participation, radical democratization kill architecture and the big gestures, etc.? And this is the kind of sweet sort of landscape approach that's already developed for holiday resorts, another mainstream kind of project. And these are drawings that Bakema produced and kept in his private archives. And as a last image, these two very different, what I call different sort of articulations of landscape and planning. Thank you.